We are going to begin our time together, and I would like to have you open to 2 Kings chapter 8. I am going to do something a little unusual to start. I am going to read verses 16 to 19, and I'm going to offer 3 2.5-minute sermons on this passage. Let me read it for at the outset for all three sermons so it's in our minds. This is again 2 Kings 8, 16 to 19. In the fifth year of Joram, the son of Ahab, king of Israel, when Jehoshaphat was king of Judah, Jehoram, the son of Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 32 years old when he became king, and he reigned 8 years in Jerusalem. And he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, as the house of Ahab had done, for the daughter of Ahab was his wife, and he did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. Yet the Lord was not willing to destroy Judah for the sake of David his servant, since he promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. Sermon number one on 2 Kings 8, 16 to 19. It's without doubt that we live in an era bereft of moral leadership. Pulpits are filled with so-called preachers merely aping what the culture says. And our politicians are no better, hand-scooping the flavor of the moment, eager to win yet another all-important election. If there ever was a moment we needed to rediscover this obscure passage from 2 Kings 8, it is now. It's an often overlooked text that tells us the story we need to hear, the story of King Jehoram. Now, before we get too far into this passage, I'm going to give you a spoiler. King Jehoram doesn't come out smelling like roses, but, and this is crucial, he is an offspring of David. And how our passage ends, if you notice at the end of verse 19, it says, Yahweh promised to give David a servant, or promised to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. A promise to give a lamp to him and to his sons forever. Of course, a reference to David, but here applied to King Jehoram. And here's why I think that is. Here's why King Jehoram is part of the lamp Israel so needed. Because we see he is a man of action. According to verse 16, that weird verse at the start, Jehoram becomes king even before his father had fully stepped down. And then it says in verse 18, he walked in the way of the kings. And even if you peek ahead to verses 20 and 21, there he's taking action again. Contrary to what the pundits of our day say, true leaders take the lead. They aren't scared about offending the political elite. They aren't slaves to the PC police. And because of this, and our passage is honest about it, because he was a man of action, he sometimes erred, just like David before him. You see it in the middle of verse 18. He did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. The implication of this combination is clear. It's better to be a man of action like David or Jehoram, who occasionally offends, who occasionally does wrong, than some weak-spined faux leader who waits his turn and plays his part and then walks off the stage. Such men of action are the light that Israel needed. Such men of action are the light America needs. Sermon number one. Now let's hear sermon number two. When the head of a nation is morally corrupt, it ultimately bankrupts the nation. And if we're not convinced of that truth, it's only because we have failed to study 2 Kings, because by the end of 2 Kings, both Israel and Judah are in exile, and the blame is placed squarely on the shoulders of its political leaders. Kings like King Jehoram of our passage. His story is very short, as is his reign. But the assessment in verse 18 is stinging. It says he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, not the kings of Judah, where some were faithful, the kings of Israel, where they were all unfaithful. And then it points out that he was like Ahab. Ahab was perhaps the worst of the kings of the northern kingdom, not someone you want to be associated with. And moreover, he had married one of Jezebel's daughters. He was morally disgusting. He did not live like a man of God. And it's kings like him that brought Israel to destruction. Brothers, we cannot think that a country that wakes at the sin in its political leader will long survive on the face of the earth. It would be bad enough if only pagans were overlooking the moral stench. It's worse. The church itself and many in it are falling over backwards to praise a modern-day King Jehoram. This ought not be so. We must learn from 2 Kings. We must learn that moral self-will and arrogance in our leaders will ultimately destroy us. Sermon number 2. Now, at some point, probably there's some in this room who are like, what conference did I sign up for? Thank you for not running me out yet. But before we start patting ourselves on the back because we don't preach those kind of sermons, I'm going to give one more. Sermon number 3. How many of us in this room are happy to proclaim and embrace the sovereignty of God when all things smell like roses, when everything's going great? It's easy to affirm that God's sovereign when life is going well. But God is also sovereign over the hard times. God so governs the universe that even the 8 years of King Jehoram's reign were under his sovereign hand. Look with me at Deuteronomy 29. You can glance there, I won't read it for time, but in verses 24 to 26, they explicitly tell us that Judah will have kings that are exactly like evil Jehoram, and it says, the evil that those kings encourage and perpetuate will lead to exile. God said this over 500 years before Jehoram even came upon the scene. I mean, talk about sovereign will. Moses was a Calvinist before Calvin even existed. And God's sovereign hand in King Jehoram's reign wasn't the last time that God would work through evil rulers to bring about his purposes. Listen to what Acts 2:23 says. This Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified and killed by the hands of lawless men. God raised him up, loosing the pangs of death because it was not possible for him to be held by it. This important story from 2 Kings 8, verses 16 to 19, makes abundantly clear God isn't just some sovereign over the good stuff. He's also sovereign over the bad. End of sermon number 3. Now here's how this worked. I chose I was going to give 3 messages. One that was loosely pro-Trump, one that was loosely anti-Trump. Offend all people equally. And then one that was pro-Calvinist. And then I chose a random passage from 2 Kings. It's easy to do. This kind of preaching is easy to do. It took me writing it took a little bit more time, but just the basic notes, 10 minutes. You know, you can do this. You don't have to be that clever, and especially in Old Testament narrative, you can make the text stretch and say whatever you want it to say. And though I've exaggerated it for the point of this talk, the reality is that we all preach sermons like this. I'm not here to make fun of anybody. This is us. This text is called Text and Framework. At Simeon Trust, we have a name for this kind of preaching. We call it inebriated preaching. Because, and here's a drawing for you, I'm a great artist. Because, oh, how about that? It's a great picture, isn't it? I drew that. Oh, there he is. This is the inebriated preacher because he uses the lamppost like a drunk uses a lamppost more for support than for illumination. We'll give him a little bottle of alcohol. Oh, that's red. There's his bottle of alcohol. He uses the text more for support than for illumination. But let me draw this one more way. I'm going to call this preaching big F, little t preaching. Or where our framework that we bring to the text is what is imposed upon the text, such that our framework is what is king and the text is not king. We all do this, and often the way we do it is unwittingly. Unaware that we're even doing it. Anyone ever heard the term confirmation bias? Raise your hand if you've heard that term. Okay, somebody tell me what confirmation bias means. Where you find what you expected to find. There's something about the human brain that people who study this kind of stuff have realized that when we look at something, we find what we expect to find. This brain has a tendency to interpret data in light of our already existing frameworks. And so, we do this work where we see it in the text, and so then the text reinforces our framework. And then it just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. So we always end up just preaching our frameworks. But there's a better way, and this is the principle of text and framework. If you want to like to write down the principles, it's this. We must let the Bible shape our frameworks rather than letting our frameworks shape our interpretation of the Bible. We must let the Bible shape our frameworks rather than letting our frameworks shape our interpretation of the Bible. Or, to put it differently, We want to be big T, little F preachers, where the text is sovereign and it's shaping our framework. I lived in the era when Rich Mullins was a Christian musician, and he has one song. He said, it's the very truth of God. He says, I didn't shape it. It's shaping me. That's exactly the point. Now, in this drawing, you'll notice we didn't erase the framework. We're not saying, get rid of frameworks. We're just asking which is king, which is shaping which. You can't get rid of your frameworks. Nor are we saying that frameworks are inherently bad. Now, some frameworks, no doubt, are better than others. But when the text is king, and this is the beautiful thing, there's another cycle that happens. Our framework gets healthier and healthier, and so when we come to the text, our framework, now we can actually see the text a little better if we're allowing the text to continually shape our framework. So we want to encourage us to have better and better frameworks. What do I mean by the term framework? Framework is basically a set of ideas or way of thinking that shape how you look at something, right? A way of looking at things that shapes how you look at things. So I want to hear from you guys. What are some examples of frameworks? What's a framework someone might have? Dispensationalism. Yeah, a dispensational framework. Law and gospel. And how we think about the interplay of law and gospel. You know, anything that's saying do, that's law, and anything that's saying done is gospel. And in every text, you need to be finding, if there's any ever a do, you got to find the done, right? What are some other frameworks? Yeah, so I'm hearing like with both law and gospel and indicative and imperative, the same. It's kind of in that same vein of like, here's a way I've been taught to read the Bible. Whenever I see an imperative, I look for an indicative. So anytime I hear a command, I want to see what is true that drives that imperative. Not a bad framework, right? And some of these aren't bad frameworks. We can debate our eschatology and which ones are bad and which ones are good. If you want to know later, I can tell you. But yeah, I mean, frameworks, some of these are great frameworks, right? We just got to be careful that we don't impose them upon the text, that we're letting the text have its voice. What about, we've given some examples of frameworks that we like are theological. How about frameworks that aren't as explicitly theological? Yeah. Personal experiences. So some frameworks are actually intrinsic. We didn't choose them. Postmodernism, that's a way of looking at truth and what truth is. Yeah. Secular humanism is a framework. Our culture, the culture that we grow up in, our gender, our racial background, those kind of things actually affect how we look at the text. The family we grew up in, right? All these different types of things. And some of these are, again, you can't change that you're male. Okay, just want to make sure. All right. So those are some examples of frameworks. And depending on which one you choose, it can actually impact how you preach and how you approach a text. Michael mentioned, our heart for at-risk children. We have two children who have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And parenting has presented some real challenges for us. And those things, I read the Bible differently because of that framework. Right? It's just like that's always happening for us. But if suddenly I'm reading that experience into every passage, I got to pause and be like, wait, is that really what it's talking about right here? Right? Is that going to be my application of the passage every week to hurting parents? You know what? All right. So, if the principle is that we want to be preachers, where our framework isn't what's being imposed upon the text, but rather the text is shaping our framework, what are some strategies that will help us move toward being big T, little f preachers, that will protect us from being inebriated preachers? Yeah, be a slave to authorial intent. That's great. As much as you can, say, but before I say I know what this text is saying, pause, set that aside for a second, and be a slave to authorial intent. Yeah, that's right. That's great. And I'd say, so this is a workshop on biblical exposition. It might be good in the first talk to define what we mean by biblical exposition. There's a lot of different definitions out there that are good. Let's work with this one for this week. A sermon where the content and intent of the passage, which is authorial intent, aligns with the content and intent of the sermon. So that approach to preaching is just going to help because you're starting with what is the text saying and why is it saying it before you start trying to bring your own ideas onto it. So that's a great principle. What's another one? It's a great strategy. What's another one to help you, help us, help me not be a framework preacher? Yeah, you don't have to raise your hand. Just shout it out. Yeah, yeah. I'm going to give you a little Simeon Trust hack. Anytime we ask you a strategy, if you say read and reread, it's going to be a right answer. Okay, that's right. Just the more you read it, it's just so true. You see more and more the more you read it. Yeah, what else? Yeah, so that's interesting. An approach to preaching that's verse by verse versus topical. I think that there are ways that are big T, little f ways of preaching that are topical. And honestly, sometimes I've found that verse by verse preachers are very big F preachers. But it's just like, okay, you know, I've got my eschatology, and there's three words in this verse that I'm going to show. These three words appear here and here and here and here, and this creates this great systematic theology of whatever my eschatology is, and it's actually not what the text is doing at all. So I want to be careful of saying that as a rule, topical is big F, little t, and as a rule, verse by verse is big T, little f. But I will say, especially if you're looking unit by unit through a book of the Bible, that's a safeguard I've put in place for myself as a preacher, is that I try to preach unit by unit through whole books of the Bible because it helps protect me from imposing what I think I need to say. And sometimes when I've chosen to preach topically, which I think it's good to mix that up on occasion, I find that I come to a passage, and once I start doing the exegesis, it's like, uh-oh, this isn't what I was hoping it was going to say. One of the worst sermons I gave, I'm glad this happened, but we were doing this summer series during COVID, outdoor services on like just comfort passages from the Bible, and I chose Jesus' words, "Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, I'll give you rest. Take my yoke upon you." That's like the easiest sermon you could ever preach, and I started doing some context work, like a little too late in the game. And those words are like a rebuke to the Pharisees. It's like, oh! So then I tried to stand up in the rain, outdoor service, and tell them about how the passage everyone loves is actually a rebuke to the Pharisees. Didn't work. Oh, well. I'm grateful for it, though. Yeah, you got to be careful with that topical stuff. Sometimes it can, oh, wow, that wasn't what I was expecting to say. Okay, so yes, what else? What's another strategy we can use to protect us from being big T preachers? Being mindful of context, yeah. Okay, so just a moment ago, Josh put this little diagram up on the board, which we're going to revisit more as we go. But there is a pathway of preparation that we talk about at the Simeon Trust, that when you follow this process, it is a safeguard. And on that first line, the one going up, that's exegesis, there's several different tools that are going to be helpful for that. And one of them is context. We're going to be talking about that later today. Another one, structure, which we're going to be talking about right after this. We're going to talk this week about melodic line, which is kind of getting a sense for the whole book. Those are all helpful things on that leg. The whole process, if you do it well, but especially that first leg, which I think is somebody else who said authorial intent. We're really trying to understand what the author was saying to them then, getting after that authorial intent, and that's a great safeguard. Yep. What else? Being sensitive to genre. Yep. So I talked about how, especially in Old Testament narrative, it's easy to let the text be putty in our hands. If we just learn some rules of narrative, which Josh is going to teach us when we think about structure, that's going to protect us if we know here's how people convey their emphasis when they're in narrative. Yeah.
What about like a...
Yeah, this is a really big one. Okay, so we're supposed to interpret the Bible in community. We're supposed to work together. So I was talking with these guys over here, and they're all pastors together, and the lead pastor does most of the preaching, but he invites these other guys to be part of the preaching team, and they join, and they work together on the passages, and they preach together. Having different voices is really important. So often, somebody else sees something I don't see. And even they might not be as theologically trained or whatever else, they see certain insights because the gifts God's given them that help me. It's not about, well, everybody's opinion's equally valid. We're not postmodern, actually. That'd be a bad framework. But often, their perspective is going to help me see the text better. I see something I didn't see. Something's drawn out that I didn't see. So doing it in community. If you're a solo pastor, it might be great to like find some other guys that aren't too far from you in this room and say, hey, can we get together and compare notes every once in a while on what we're preaching and learn from each other? I'd also say this, commentaries can serve that function as well. So to be, don't ever view a commentary as the authority on the text. View it as a conversation partner. Sometimes I'll even actually spread commentaries around me and give them a chair or something like that. It's somewhat convenient. I'm not that weird. But and it's like, okay, I want to have a conversation with so-and-so on this one. I want to hear what so-and-so thought about this. Not because they're right and I'm wrong. I mean, it very well could be. But I'm not just going to say that's the answer. But I want to hear. And here especially, anybody who's a text who's making observations about the text is helpful. But for this point especially, if somebody's outside of your tribe, so think about that. You can think about that theologically. You can think of that culturally. You can think of that in terms of your era in time, like history. It's great to read people, as long as they're text people, who are seeing the text. So people who don't believe in the authority of God's word and I would be witnessing too if I was actually in a room with them. Sometimes they've been the most helpful to me in seeing the text because they just see certain things I don't see because they don't have the same framework. So yeah, those are, you just said one thing and I made this huge big thing. But yes, hearing from others. One or two others, I got a couple I want to mention as well. Yeah. The more we have a ballast of the understanding the Bible as a whole, that's helpful. And really, that's the cycle, right? The text keeps shaping our framework. Now, there are people who have their framework and do the other one. They do the big F preaching, and being in the text just is reinforcing their framework more and more and more. So as long as we're big T, little F guys, then the more we're in the Bible, the better our framework is going to get. Here's one I think that's really important. When you're in a passage and there's something that doesn't make sense or rubs you the wrong way, what do you do with it? That is a big flag saying, This is a good time to stop and make sure your framework's small. Make sure the text is shaping your framework, not the other way around. In a similar vein, if you find yourself starting to explain away the passage, that's a really good time to be like, wait a second. I'm trying to tell people why what this seems to be saying isn't what it's saying. Now, I'm not saying every time you have to give some qualification or nuance, you're doing that. I'm just saying that's a time to pause and say, am I imposing my framework? Okay, I want to do an exercise for we got a little bit of time here left before question and answer. So open up to 2 Kings 5. All right. We are going to look at 2 Kings 5, 1-6 and 7-14. And we're going to go about four rows back. So that means this part of the room, you have 1-6. And this part of the room, you have 7-14. Look, talk with the people who are sharing a table with you or someone nearby and tell me what frameworks, you know, if you are a big F, little t preacher, how might you preach this passage? What are some frameworks you might want to preach from this passage? So the guys in the front have 1-6. The people in the back have 7-14. 2 Kings 5, 1-6 and 7-14. Be framework preachers. What frameworks are you inclined to impose upon this text or preach from this text? Not you personally. Could be you personally. Maybe it's a little early in the week for that. It could be some theoretical person out there might do this. All right. I want to hear. Let's start with the front of the room, verses 1-6. What are some good, I say good, enjoyable frameworks that one might that might shape how you would want to preach this text? 1-6. Yeah.
So I grew up in a Boston, so this passage was one that my dad's pastor. He would come to this passage often, and he kind of built his whole theology of healing off a passage like this.
Okay, so this is a great place to go if you believe in healing. This is a great passage to go to build a whole theology around. This is how healing happens. Yeah, that's great. What's another one? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that'll get your blood going. Just give me a little bit more money and you might get some spiritual blessing. And that's Naaman's thinking, right? And so we could just say, it's true. This is the right approach. Naaman is the right approach. Yeah, okay. So prosperity gospel could be there. What's another one? Yeah. Wow. Okay. All right. Now we got a sermon going. Did you guys hear what he said? He said he started with feminist, but he went a full intersectionality on this. Power and balance. And then he talked about speaking truth to power and the importance of that. Okay, so hold on to that one. We're going to go to the back. What are some frameworks from the second half? Baptismal regeneration. I'm a Baptist, man. This seeing somebody go all the way down makes me happy. He didn't get sprinkled to get healed. That's great. I'm making the Presbyterians feel unwelcome. You're welcome here. That's eisegeting. That's not what we're about here. Okay. What else? What's another one? Yeah. So this is a way for the pastor to establish his authority. Like, you know, I can give direction and do as I tell you to do on all sorts of matters. Okay, what's another one? Yeah. Yeah. Okay, how would you do that? Okay. So it's a corrective to nationalism. Right? So Naaman had to overcome his nationalism in order to be healed. Okay. All right. So we're going to go just one step further on this, okay? So conceptually, you got your frameworks. I just want you to develop them a little bit further. I want you to pick one. It could be the it could be one somebody else said. So it could be for these front guys. It could be that whole speaking truth to power, intersectionality, that kind of thing. Choose one. It could be one you heard or one that you guys discussed that you didn't say out loud, front or back. But I want you to just develop a bit of a sermon, maybe a title and a couple of points that arise from the text. And we're having a little fun with this. That's like, I want to have some energy. Like I like creating a little bit of stir, whatever. I started with those three sermons. It's a bit of a risk, right? We're having a little fun with this, but we're holding up a mirror to ourselves here. We're not laughing and pointing the fingers at other people, right? So we're doing this to see in kind of almost a caricature sort of way what we ourselves might be doing. So I just want that heart and tone, but have some fun with it. But try and make a somewhat realistic sermon based on a bad framework, right? Or it could be even a good framework, but that's not what this text is teaching. So have some fun with it. Title and a couple of points for your passage. Go after it with the people that you're neighbors with. All right, my fellow inebriated preachers. My fellow big F little T preachers. I wanna hear what you guys came up with. We'll start with the front. I do want to say this. I'll start with the front. Who's got a title and a couple of points from 5:1-6 that would really just, that's going to preach, man. You guys are preachers. Yeah. Wow. You can just go home now. You're ready. Speak the truth, girl. Speak the truth. Watch the world heal. Woo! Man, hang up the cleats. What's another one? I don't know. It doesn't have to top that one. Girl is the word? Okay. Big man, little words is the first point. Little girl, big words. I like that too. We got some preachers in the room, Josh. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. One more from the front. Yeah. Hey, you stole that from me. Okay, man of action. I'm on the same page. Man, we need men of action today. Yeah. Stand through weakness and lead humbly. So this is a totally different framework. And you can see how probably some of us in this room might be a little bit more inclined to this sermon, right? To preach it this way. So man of action, what is a true man of action? Naaman, and we could back this up, Naaman in the what follows is going to be, a convert, it seems, right? So yeah, so here's a man of action, and okay, your points again one more time. Stand through weakness. I mean, I don't want to be flippant here, but I know what it's like to be weak, and if I preach this sermon right here, we could feel that. Like you just got to be able to stand through weakness. And the next one was, and lead humbly. So when you, like Naaman, are struck with whatever the leprosy of pastoral ministry, whatever it is. Why are you guys laughing? I feel bad for you're laughing at me. I feel that sometimes. Oh well, here's what God says to you. Look to Naaman's example. He stood through that. Just keep going. Just keep going and be humble. Let God grow you in humility through that. Okay, back in the back. What are some, you guys, there's a lot of competition with the front here. Let's see how the back row Baptists are doing. Yeah, go ahead in the middle. Okay, here's what I like about that as a framework sermon. Probably all those things, the three subpoints, I think you could all show they're true from the Bible. Like some of them are explicit quotes of the Bible, right? So it's not like this is a terrible, I'm just hearing that sermon off the top of my head. It's not like it's a terrible sermon. You're saying true things. Just not what that text is saying, right? That's often how we preach framework. What I'm saying is true. It's just not what this text is saying. Yeah, what else? Yeah, over here. Oh, man, we need to get some elevation worship going right now. Whew. I listen to it. I like it. Some of it. Okay. All right, last one over here. Where are you from? Okay. Okay. Man, I think I saw on YouTube a guy who preached something like that once. Like, he was like calling out his congregation, like, why don't you obey me? So those kind of sermons are out there. Don't do them. Don't be this guy. Book called authority. All right, I'm not sure if that's what I was teaching. All right. So I'm going to restate the principle. We must let the Bible shape our frameworks rather than letting our framework shape our interpretation of the Bible. We need to be big T, little F people. What's going to be fun about this passage is we're going to do some of this pathway of preparation stuff, on this passage. And I love the variety of stuff we had. Some of it was like, that's good preaching in the sense of like, you're saying good things. Some of it was really bad, but when we do the work, we're going to find that actually God's word is really powerful. And our little clever dreams that we dream up and say, thus saith the Lord, are not nearly as powerful as what the Holy Spirit is actually doing when we see the content and intent of the passage for the original audience. I should tell you, because we're about to do structure, and I think we're going to be using this as an example structure. I wrote down the wrong verses. I was supposed to go to verse 7 and then pick up at verse 8. So don't think that, Josh, that was not what I thought the structure of the passage was. So just to work ahead there.